Hey, VRIP community, it's Matt here. Hope you're having a great and relaxing break. It's New Year's Eve tomorrow night, and I was just informed by the CBC app that alcohol will not be served after 8 p.m. in restaurants or anywhere else. So it should be a real exciting New Year's break out the Yahtzee. This week, we're doing a best of episode over the holiday break. It occurred to us that, you know, we've been doing this for close to 5 years now. And we have a lot of new listeners who undoubtedly have not heard some of our really excellent episodes from the past. So today we're going to revisit an episode with Harvard Extension School's Theo Nicolai from April 5th, 2018. Very different market, very different world, talking about real estate cycles. This is evergreen, phenomenal information for anyone interested in real estate. It never gets dated. It never goes out of style. So enjoy this. Even if you heard it around the first time, you'll benefit from a second listen. I know I did for sure. And just wanted to let you know, we'll be back with our regular programming next week with the BCREA. That's the BC Real Estate Association's chief economist, Brendan Ogmanson. We spoke to him right before we went on holiday, and I can tell you, he's big on forecasts. We talk all things 2021. It is the perfect episode to start off what is seeming to be a busy, busy year. So hope you guys have a great new year. We'll be back next week and enjoy our talk with Theo Nicolai about the four stages of a real estate cycle. Happy New Year.
Hello.
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 This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt, today we've got Theo Nicolai.
Theo Nicolai is a super impressive guy. He's an instructor at Harvard, Harvard graduate. But more importantly for us, he has years and years of experience in the real estate industry.
Absolutely. He was the director of finance and acquisitions for a real estate company in Illinois with over $500 million in holdings. He's also the president and founder of Nicolai LLC, which is a real estate investment company in, I believe, Denver, Colorado.
Yeah, he's out of Colorado. And the reason we had him on is he wrote an article for the Harvard Extension School detailing market cycles, what to look for, and how to judge where you are in a real estate market cycle. And it's a super sophisticated analytical tool, and it's a super sophisticated analysis. So we asked Theo to come on the show, and he was generous enough to do so.
No, and you know what? It's one of the clearest outlines of how real estate market cycles work, because we constantly are talking to people that, you know, say, oh, it's a five-year cycle, or oh, it's a seven-year cycle. But they don't really back it up as to why they think it's a cycle. It's almost like it's just the duration of the cycle, regardless of any changes in the in what's going on in the market or any other external
globally
factors.
Interest rates.
next year the cycle's gonna, you know, next year is gonna be the bad year.
Yeah,
and it I don't find that a useful framework.
Well, it's not compelling at all.
Well, but, exactly.
But this, on the other hand, is a very useful four-stage analysis.
Yep.
The question always is that it's very difficult to determine exactly where you are, but this is a useful tool.
When you're looking at it, though, you recognize things that are playing out in the Vancouver market, right?
Sure.
When we talk to Theo, you'll definitely think of certain things in our marketplace.
Yeah,
for sure.
Absolutely.
But before we get to that, Matt, the stats are not out yet today. We got the board stats coming out probably tomorrow, I think, or maybe this week.
Maybe even later today.
Yeah.
We'll have the real estate board stats. They'll be up on our site. We also have the other real estate stats that we talked about last week that outline sales ratios and really break down what's happening in sub-areas.
Sub-areas and sales ratios are the most important thing that you should be looking at. I mean, sales ratios are really interesting. What's happening in the market really on the ground level, and what kind of, you know, what's selling, right?
Exactly.
I mean, if you have 100 listings on the market, are 10 of them selling? Are we in a buyer's market? Are we in a seller's market? And it's really nice. They actually break them down by price band. They break them down by area. It's fantastic
and,
stuff.
And we can't put those on the site, but we do release those in our newsletter. So go over to VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com and sign up for that, and we'll have that out in this week's newsletter.
Speaking of the market, though, Matt, what are your thoughts? I mean, generally speaking, we are in a market still where, you know, detached is pretty soft. The high end of the market is pretty soft. But we have been noticing, you know, we've had the last year or so of it's been the tail of two markets, right?
Right, a robust attached market, right? And exactly. that there's subtle shifts right now where it seems to be changing a little bit. And obviously, we've talked quite a bit about all the governmental actions and the interest rate hikes right. and the stress tests and everything else that are going to potentially impact this market. And it seems to be impacting it ever so slightly right now.
Absolutely. And it's really tough to get a solid read on it because it's just been, I mean, we're coming off of Easter weekend.
Yeah.
Which is always soft and slow and, you know, people are away and everything else. So it's difficult to get a really strong read. I feel like the inventory is going to be coming actually this week and next. A lot of people kind of start picking up for the spring market after Easter.
Exactly. But, and I think, you know, we talked to tons of realtors. We're doing open houses every weekend. Everyone's saying, yeah, it's a strange market right now. It's hard to figure out why certain things are selling and certain things aren't.
Right.
But we've talked about a way that we think about how the market's working before using this tier one, tier two system.
So what exactly is a tier two property then?
So a tier two property is a property that doesn't have parking, has a view maybe looking into a bridge,
dumpster.
Or a dumpster or a hydro substation,
right.
You know, a negative view, outdoor space, maybe it's lacking outdoor space, maybe it has a wonky floor plan, maybe it's on the busy side, loud side of the building. There's some negative attributes. And in a busy market, those attributes go overlooked because people are desperate to get in. You know, there's multiple offers on everything,
right.
The fear of missing out, all of those things, right? And what we're seeing right now is that some of those tier two properties are sitting while all the tier ones are still selling. So you'll talk to agents where they're like, I don't understand. Your listing got seven offers and mine got skunked on the weekend.
Yeah.
Seven and zero. What's the story? And this tier one, tier two framework is, I think, a really useful way of thinking about it.
Yeah, interesting. And so just to, and I know people can probably put it together, but tier one properties alternatively are everything that's not a tier two, right? I mean, they've got the fantastic view or the better exposure.
Yeah.
They're on the quiet side of the building or just a quiet street in general. Maybe they have parking. Maybe they're in a great building. Maybe they have a large outdoor space. These are the types of properties when you're considering the attributes of a unit for purchase or a house for purchase. These are the things you really want to consider because you'll be much stronger positioned in any market, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And we should say, obviously, this suggests that the market in the attached market is actually softening, right? Because those tier two properties last year were going like gangbusters. This spring, we're seeing more sitting on the market. So
it's a question of fewer buyers out or maybe a little bit more inventory kind of coming to market in certain areas and really price sensitive, right? It seems
for sure.
It's really dependent on the price band. And that's actually, again, why you need those stats that we put out. So you can actually look and see where your property is, where it's positioned within certain price bands and how many homes are selling in any given month based on the inventory, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So quickly, Matt, before we get to that, we'll mention one more thing. If you are actually thinking of selling your house, we've also got a research tool so you can monitor how to basically monitor what your home's worth. We've talked about the tools out there where you just go to the site and it says, how much is my home worth? And you plug it in and it takes like four random comparables from the area.
Well, yeah.
Not very useful.
Not very useful. It also takes, you know, how large is your house after you put in the address? You have to say how many bedrooms, how the square
right.
footage. I mean, clearly it's a system that needs some work. I think they're putting this all on a computer is not a super useful way of gauging what your home's worth.
No, there's too many subjective factors. So we actually have something that's way more useful than that. So let us know if you want to sign up for your home for this, and it will actually update you with sales immediately around your area. And then there is some legwork on your behalf or on our behalf, depending if you want to engage us to help you out with that. But let us know. Sign up at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com and leave your home address in the comments.
Absolutely. But maybe we should cut to this talk with Teo Nicolai, because this is a good one.
This is a fantastic one. Without further ado, here's our interview with Teo Nicolai.
Enjoy.
Okay, so we're here with Teo Nicolai, Harvard instructor and real estate investor. How you doing, Teo?
I'm doing great. How you doing today?
Fantastic. Yeah, thanks for taking the time, Teo.
So Teo, can you maybe start by just telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I teach real estate finance and investment at Harvard Extension School, and it's our program is online. It's open enrollment, so we get a lot of people who join to learn about real estate. And we even offer real estate investment certificates. So I get to interact with a lot of entrepreneurs and a lot of investors around the world who are involved in real estate. And that's a great pleasure for me. I also, of course, invest in real estate on my own. I'm the president of Nicolai LLC, and we invest in apartments, and we're also active in fix and flips.
And how long have you been investing in real estate?
I've been investing in real estate since 2004. So it's been I've been through one cycle, and I'm looking forward to seeing how this next cycle develops.
Right.
And so, Teo, we brought you on because we know you think about real estate in a really deep way. What fundamentally drives home prices?
That's an excellent question, and it's one that surprisingly is misunderstood around the world. So to really understand what fundamentally drives prices, and particularly home prices, we have to go way back. There is an economist named David Ricardo back in 1817, and he introduced what we now know is Ricardo's Law of Rents. So without going into all the details, what David Ricardo noticed was after the Napoleonic Wars, the price of corn skyrocketed throughout Europe and England. And people noticed at the same time that land rent had also been skyrocketing. And so people came to the conclusion, the very common sense conclusion, that the price of corn had been going up because so much rent was being paid. And everyone listening to this, and we've all been through this, we've all heard the phrase, we have to raise prices because our rents are going up. What David Ricardo realized was that it works in exactly the opposite way. He found out that the price of corn was not high because rents were being charged, but rather rents went up because the price of corn was up. And that applies in every aspect of real estate. That is to say that operators, our users of land, realize some benefit from using that land. A store owner will operate at a particular location because they expect to make a profit, or someone will live in a particular city because they enjoy living there. And that is what bids the price up. There is a Harvard professor named Edward Glaser who wrote a fantastic book about this. It's called Triumph of the City. And one of the things he noted, and this will be particularly relevant for Vancouver, is that lower real income, meaning people are spending a greater portion of their income on housing, is actually a sign of a thriving city, not a city that's in trouble. And let me tell you what I mean by that. If you look at prices, and we know that home prices in Vancouver are very high. We're at just about $1.7 million right now on average. I did some research online. Everyone can look this up and find that you can, if you don't want to pay $1.7 million, you have a lot of options. If you want to move to Yellowknife, you can get a home for about $460,000, right? Thunder Bay is even cheaper. So the question is, has everyone in Vancouver lost their minds? Why are people in Vancouver paying four times as much as they could pay to instead live in Yellowknife? Well, what we know is people in Vancouver are not being irrational. What's happening is there is a really good, compelling reason to live in Vancouver. Vancouver has one of the lowest, or British Columbia in general, has one of the lowest unemployment rates in Canada. You're at 4.6%. Employment growth went up by 3.4% last year. And that's what that speaks to is that there are opportunities in Vancouver. In addition to the job market, of course, people just love living in Vancouver. So, you've got Stanley Park, you've got a great aquarium, you've got a great outdoor recreation setup. And so people are flocking to Vancouver for the lifestyle and the jobs, and therefore they're willing to pay to be there. You could live in Yellowknife for a quarter of the price, but you wouldn't have access to all the amenities and all the jobs and all the reasons why people want to live in Vancouver. And so consequently, from a fundamental standpoint, what really drives prices, home prices and real estate prices, is the desirability of that area. The more desirable the area, the more people are willing to pay to be there. And Vancouver, in a sense, is a victim of its own success. But no one would be paying these high prices if they didn't want to be there.
Right. So, and what would you say? I mean, there's a lot of people here that look at, say, the price to income ratios, and they say Vancouver's way out of whack as compared to almost any city in North America. This fundamentally speaks to a problem with the market or a distortion in this market.
Sure, and that's certainly the price to income ratio is a great metric for looking at to understand the overall affordability of the city. But the key thing to think about in prices, and we study a lot of this in economics, is that people pay a price in exchange for getting something. Mm-hmm. So when you're renting an apartment or when you're buying a home, you're not just buying the sink and the refrigerator and the three bedrooms, or the two bedrooms or the one bedroom, as the case may be. You're buying all of that and access to the locale. So there's an amenity that's happening. When you live in Vancouver, you have access to all of these things, which you wouldn't get if you lived in, again, Yellowknife. And I don't mean to get any hate mail from Yellowknife, but I can see that coming. But the bottom line is that you're getting a package deal. You're buying the home and you're buying everything around the home. And so consequently, there's value to that. And you can monetize that. And that's what we see. We see people paying more of their income to live in Vancouver, and we see this in Seattle, in the United States, we see this in Seattle and San Francisco and even Denver. And people are paying more and more of their income, but the reason they're paying it is because they're getting a lot more. It is, and again, without getting hate mail from Yellowknife, I think it's more enjoyable in terms of amenities when you buy a one-bedroom condo in Vancouver than a one-bedroom condo in Yellowknife. You get more for what you're paying, and mm-hmm. people are willing to pay more because they're getting so much more.
Right, right. So, Teo, you wrote a piece called How to Use Real Estate Trends to Predict the Next Housing Bubble. You point to a cycle in which real estate markets inescapably move. Can you detail this cycle and the four stages for our listeners?
Sure, absolutely. So real estate is absolutely fascinating in the sense that it really does move through a very predictable four-stage cycle. And what's even more interesting about that is the cycle tends to be about 18 years, and it can vary, but by and large, since the 1800s, we've been monitoring this, and it is consistently around an 18-year cycle. So the cycle starts out, and the way to measure the cycle is looking at occupancy. What we know is, just very briefly before we get into the actual cycle, is that people tend to think of prices and rents. That's what we look at when we're trying to understand what's going on in our market. We ask what the rents are and what the prices are. But prices and rents are byproducts of something else that's happening. They're the effect, but not the cause. What the cause of the real estate cycle and what drives prices up, you know, from a day-to-day standpoint, truly is occupancy. Occupancy refers to how many seats around the table currently have someone sitting in them, how many seats are empty. And for people wanting to understand the real estate cycle, you want to look at really occupancy or its counterpoint, which is vacancy. And those statistics are largely available, and they will tell you more about the real estate cycle than any other statistic that's out there. So in terms of that real estate cycle, again, there are four phases. The first phase of the real estate cycle is the recovery phase. It's basically coming out of a recession. And we all remember what a recession feels like. You've got high unemployment. You've got a lot of storefronts that are vacant. You've got a lot of apartments that are vacant, a lot of homes that are for sale and there aren't buyers. That is the result of low economic activity. Land is essential to every economic activity. And so consequently, if we're in a situation where there's lower economic activity, there's lower demand for land, there are more available units. Occupancy is low. The number of, again, vacancy is high, and the number of homes for sale would be higher. We see in a recession that governments tend to step in. They tend to undertake stimulus, and there's just natural growth of population. And consequently, we start to see that economic activity start to arrive. we start to see occupancy increase. So more people are, more businesses are opening new stores. We see that people are that used to be four to a household, now it's two to a household. So that occupancy starts to increase. And that's the phase one of the real estate cycle recovery is a time when occupancy, current occupancy, is below long run average, but it's creeping up. Mm-hmm. At that time, there's still downward pressure on rents. And that is to say, we have a lot of available units. We've got a lot of homes for sale. We've got a lot of apartments for rent. We've got a lot of storefronts that are vacant. And so that generally puts downward pressure on rents and prices. Where that starts to change is at the transition between phase one and phase two. In phase two, we call that the expansion phase. Phase two is just like phase one. It's the recovery is coming. There's more economic activity going on, and occupancy has been increasing, which is great. And now, unfortunately, we experience scarcity. Suddenly, there are very few apartments that are available, very few condos and homes that are available for sale, very few storefronts that are available. And now we see upward pressure on rents. We see people who want to rent those places. They want to live in the city, but they can't find anywhere to rent, and so they're bidding up the price. So phase two, we see occupancy increasing. We see a lot of good economic activity, but now we start to see prices going up. And the thing about real estate, which everyone knows, is that real estate works just like any other market. If prices go up, you start to see new supply. But where real estate is very different from other markets is in the lag time between when the demand for new units is felt and when those new units are actually supplied.
Right.
So phase two, during that expansion phase, things are going great, but we're not seeing any new supply yet. We're the early stages of that period. We're not seeing new supply because it takes a really long time to build. So that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And we've been experiencing that here in Vancouver for quite some time. I mean, the city's very slow at allowing builders and developers for permits. It takes forever. So, we've seen that. Yeah.
Yeah. To build a 200 unit condo tower, you're talking about, you're talking about a period of usually 4 to 6 years,
right,
from when the time the developer says, let's pull the trigger on this, to the time they get all the permits, they secure the land, they get the financing, then they start the construction, then they finish the construction, and then there's a whole sales period. And so consequently, what happens is we start to see a lot of construction in phase two, that expansion phase, but we're only starting to see a little bit of deliveries. And what's happening, of course, is the economy is recovering and people are being born and people are moving to the city. And so they're pushing up those rents, but there are no new units available for them to occupy. And that competition for space pushes prices up further and further. As prices go up further and further, developers start to say, hey, we should start developing, we should start building new. So they begin new projects. But again, it can take a long time. It can take 3, 4, 5, 6 years before a meaningful amount of supply is delivered. And throughout that entire period, the economic expansion continues, prices keep getting pushed up, and then people start to panic because occupancy is really, really high. There's no available inventory. And despite the fact that we all see cranes in the skyline, we're not seeing those new units yet. Mm-hmm. Those units start to get delivered in the end of the expansion phase, and that starts to slowly quench the thirst for new inventory, for spaces for people to rent and for homes for people to buy. And that starts to quench that thirst, which is great for the market. And that starts to decrease that pressure on occupancy. Occupancy starts to slow down as new units are developed. And then finally it peaks because the amount of new units that are coming online start to match the demand for those units. And that brings us into phase three. Phase three of the real estate cycle is hypersupply. What we're referring to, and you can imagine where we are in this market, is we still have very high occupancy. So we still have upward pressure on rents. We still have upward pressure on prices. We have a lot of people trying to find space that can't. But now the delivery of new units is on our side. So a lot of new units start, those units that we started seeing the delivery of them in phase two are now being delivered. A lot more of them are coming online. The construction engine is in full gear and is delivering a massive amount of all those units that have been under construction for the last 5 years or so. and that starts pushing occupancy down. So the difference between phase two and phase three is that in both cases, upward pressure on rents, but now in phase three, hypersupply, the magnitude of supply that's coming online is starting to push that occupancy down. So it's a lot of new units coming online, and suddenly we're starting to see occupancy fall. Now, it's important to remember that the way this works is that whenever current occupancy is above long-run average occupancy, you're still going to have upward pressure on rents. There still aren't enough seats to go around. There's still intense bidding for those seats. And so phase three is the weirdest phase to be in. The hypersupply phase is like a weird nightmare for real estate investors. And the reason I say that is because the rents are going up, but occupancy is starting to go down. And you can start to see that this massive wave of new supply is coming into existence and dumping onto the market. And that's pushing occupancy down at a time when, paradoxically, rents are still rising. They're rising because scarcity still exists, even though new supply is being delivered. That phase comes to an end, as you can probably imagine, and introduces us into phase four, which is the recession. Phase four occurs, the difference between phase three and phase four is that in both cases, occupancy is decreasing. It's decreasing because a lot of new supply is coming online. But the difference and the turning point is that when current occupancy falls below long-run average, that's when we're in phase four, a recession. And what has happened is that gigantic construction engine has been just churning out units that have been in the pipeline for 5 or 6 or 7 years, and they start getting delivered, pushes down occupancy. Suddenly the need for those units really isn't there anymore because the prices aren't as high as they used to be, or in real terms are kind of flattening out. But that doesn't stop the machine. We have a pipeline that has 5 or 6 or 7 years worth of development that is gearing up to deliver all of those. And that punishing supply comes into the market and pushes occupancy down, pushes it below the long run average, pushes it into that recession where we have below average rent, or we below average occupancy, which is driving rents down. And because new units are coming online, occupancy is falling as well. And so that's a scary time. That's the real nightmare in real estate, because there's very little room for real estate developers to change their plan, even though the market that they were building for no longer exists. So those are the four stages of real estate, the real estate cycle. Phase one, recovery. Phase two, expansion. Phase three, hypersupply. And phase four, recession. Eventually, all those, the developers, we go bankrupt. We stop building. That bottoms out the occupancy, occupancy is no longer falling. And then suddenly we start the cycle again.
So, Teo, we've definitely seen that cycle play out in different cities. Are there cities that are exceptions to this four-stage process? Like, I'm thinking about perhaps cities that might be landlocked, or any other sort of city that might defy this logic?
You know, typically we don't see that. What we do see is disruptions in the cycle. So the cycle I've just described is repeated in almost every major city. Because of that delay between when the inventory is needed and when it's actually delivered, that lag suddenly that may prolong the upswing, and we also see government policies which restrict supply also extending the real estate cycle, and that's something Vancouver experiences, both of those,
right,
which can temporarily disrupt the cycle. And what I mean by that is it can lengthen the different terms of it. It can exacerbate the heights, but eventually you still run into the same cycle.
Can you just speak a little bit more? We have a lot of investors that listen to the program about occupancy and what to look for, like in terms of occupancy, in terms of rents and sales. Like, how would you be monitoring that?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So from an academic standpoint, we use occupancy because intuitively it helps us really understand, you know, higher occupancy means higher rents. So it's kind of it's easier to understand. From the publication standpoint, for people who are looking for the actual data, we actually flip that on its head. We speak in terms of vacancy and an inventory. So if you're an investor in apartments, what you're really looking for is the vacancy rate. and you're trying to understand which way the vacancy rate is moving. If the vacancy rate is going down, that means we're in phase, that likely means we're in phase two at this point in Vancouver's cycle, which is to say that more people are moving in. There's still a demand that's not being met, and therefore vacancy is falling. The single family home equivalent of that is there's three of them. One thing they want to look at is the total inventory. How many homes are currently for sale, and is that inventory rising or is it falling? Two other metrics that people want to look at are days on market, meaning how long is a home for sale before it goes under contract.
Right.
And obviously, again, the faster that it goes under contract, the more that suggests that there's a lot more demand than there is supply. And then finally, months of inventory, which is basically it's our way of saying, if no more homes went on the market today, how long would the current inventory last at the current absorption rate? And the bottom line is that the shorter the days, the months of inventory, that means we don't have a lot of supply. And again, that will tell you that rents or the prices should be going up at that point, because there's just not enough seats at the table, and you got way more people looking for the homes than there are homes to be purchased.
So are you using, just so I understand, Teo, so you're looking at days of on the market, you're looking at supply, and when is a perfect time for an investor to actually try and time the buy?
Sure. Well, I will say this. One of the things that I have learned from doing this for a very long time is that timing the market is extraordinarily difficult in terms of finding that perfect moment. But in general, what you'd want to look for is a situation where you're entering that second phase. So the idea is we're coming out of a recession, we're recovering from that, and we now are experiencing higher than average occupancy and then rent growth and price appreciation. So what I would say is if I could wave my magic wand and if I could pick when I would invest, it's when we're coming out of that recovery, that first phase.
Sure.
And we're entering that second phase. We see that is likely passed, that the moment has passed for that in Vancouver. But that being said, it's a long cycle, and there's never really a bad time to be in the market. The only mistake investors make is overpaying. So that's the one mistake you can't undo in real estate, is overpaying.
Right.
So, Teo, presumably you monitor many different markets. Just in terms of these cycles, and I guess you're focused primarily in the United States, but are these cycles, is it kind of a national phenomenon, or is it city specific? And secondly, for an investor, say in Vancouver, that's potentially looking at other markets, like the cycle you're describing is so long, if you feel like you're not hitting it at the right time, you potentially have another 9-10 years or whatever, however long you think it's going to be. I mean, what is your strategy there?
Sure. We tend to see the cycles are matching up, and that's actually very interesting for us. So we're seeing more and more that the real estate cycles we're at more or less the same point in the United States, as in Canada, as in Europe. So the idea is that we're starting to see that happen more and more, and there's still some differences because there's different policies and different government policies that affect markets. But largely, we see more or less a similar cycle. That being said, there is, within any given country, there is a widespread of where different cities are in the cycle. And so you may have cities that are well into phase three hypersupply, where their occupancies are already on the way down. We've got a lot of inventory being delivered. And in that same country, you can also have cities which are just emerging from the first phase, and they're just starting to experience rent growth, but aren't seeing meaningful supply yet. So there is definitely a range of where cities will fall. And then finally, and this is something to think about, is that product types differ in the cycle. So you can have a city wherein apartments are in hypersupply, but single family homes have not yet hit that point, because the construction of single family homes tends to lag behind apartment construction by about 2 to 3 to 4 years. office and retail might even fall further behind, because that, again, just the nature of the forces that cause the scarcity, the upward pressure in rents, and then the incentive to develop are different for apartments than for office buildings. And so even so, what the neat trick is, if you can move from product type to product type, you can move to different parts of the cycle, because different product types will be at different points in their cycle.
So Taylor, there's a lot of people that are calling Vancouver a bubble currently. Are there analytical measures that you use for predicting bubbles, in several different markets across the North America, call it?
Sure. Well, so in an interesting thing about bubbles is they have two things have to happen in order for a bubble to be a bubble. First and foremost, you have rapid increase in prices. And secondly, that rapid increase is not supported on a fundamental level. That is to say, it is an increase in price, but not of value. In Vancouver, what's interesting is that you've got, by and large, a very well-supported market. And I go back to the unemployment, which is, again, one of the lowest in Canada, and certainly lowest one of the lowest in British Columbia. And you've got good rent growth, or good employment growth, rather. You had 3.4% employment growth last year. And what that means is you got more jobs. So you've got more people wanting to fill those jobs, and you probably have an upward pressure on wages. I say probably, because it depends on the specific industry. But by and large, as long as there is employment growth, you're likely to see more migration, more people wanting to use to occupy that city, and therefore will come to it. So my number one thing I look at is the employment growth likely to continue to support in migration? If the answer is yes, then I'm not as concerned about bubbles. Where I get concerned about bubbles is when you have an increase in price that isn't well supported. There aren't people moving in. There aren't new jobs coming. So how is this price level likely to continue to be supported? So I will say that by and large, the number one indicator I look for is employment growth, because that precedes all the other economic activities. The curveball, of course, in Vancouver continues to be the foreign investment and how much of the price appreciation is due to foreign investment versus which can leave very quickly versus jobs, which tend not to leave quickly.
Right. So Teo, there's a certain inevitableness to the idea of a cycle, and it's a very attractive simplicity. What are your thoughts on why so many people have got Vancouver wrong? And we've had a lot of them on the podcast. Did all these folks just misread where we were in the cycle, or are they unaware of the cycle, or is there something else going on?
There's an old phrase that's out there which says that economists were put on the planet to make astrologists look good. It doesn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me that economists get it wrong. We get it wrong all the time. So it's important to understand that just when we think we've got something, the market has an embarrassing way of proving us wrong. What I would say is that they're not wrong about the cycle. We're just often wrong about exactly where we are in the cycle and how long we're going to be in this position. The real estate cycle, that occupancy, that increase and decrease in occupancy and the driver of rent growth is largely due to new supply. And that's the 800-pound gorilla that is driving the real estate cycle.
Right.
But that being said, that gorilla can get distracted or offset by unexpected changes in demand, as well as government policies that restrict supply. So again, you can imagine that higher than expected job growth is going to lead to higher than expected in-migration, which is going to lead to more demand. And that means that new supply that we just watched come in gets quickly absorbed, not by the existing population, but rather because there's so much new migration. Similarly, we can imagine there's a lot of construction that needs to happen. But because of certain policies, because it takes a long time for permitting, or for a variety of reasons, that supply does not materialize. So again, what I would say is that I don't think that anyone's wrong with regard to the cycle itself, but rather there are some curveballs that can get thrown in that can prolong where we are in the cycle.
So, Teo, like, an 18-year timeline to me, I'm just thinking about this right now, that makes me a bit nervous as an investor. That means that I probably have three timelines in my life to actually capitalize on. Is that a typical length of a timeline, and do you see a lot of deviation in that time frame?
It is typical, and this is one of the great things
Adam's
about
not,
real estate.
Doesn't plan to live till 60. It sounds like, but anyway,
well, I won't be operating.
Well, you know, what they say is that, you know, and it really is in a career, a typical real estate career might be 2 years or 3 years or three cycles if we're lucky. The first cycle is to basically have the universe beat into investors the nature of the real estate cycle. The second cycle is where investors tend to make money because they realize they know what's coming. They've seen it before. They know not to overly despair during the downtimes, and they know to be cautious during the good times. And so both of those things, the market has a great way of educating us. I call it tuition. When we lose a bunch of money in the market, that's just tuition. That's the market. That's the market teaching you what you need to be prepared for the next time around. So real estate careers are made in experience, typically in 2 to 3 cycles.
And what metrics do you use to predict the severity of a downturn?
The severity of the downturn can be predicted with 2 major indicators. The first is employment, and the second is supply. So to the extent that you have way more supply than is needed, that will certainly lead to a much deeper downturn. Because again, that new supply generally doesn't get delivered until halfway through the hypersupply phase or into recession. So we could be experiencing a devastating real estate recession and still have new units being delivered. It's not that those developers were crazy. They just started building the late in the cycle, but the market that they built for no longer exists.
Right.
The second thing is employment. They're played. And the reason I say it's overplayed again is to go back to the Yellowknife Vancouver comparison. You can get a wonderful 3-bedroom home in Yellowknife for about $460,000. But you don't get everything else that you get when you buy in Vancouver. And so consequently, people's decision to spend a lot of their income on housing really is the decision to spend a lot of their income on the house and everything around the house that they value.
Right. We had a guest a long time ago, but it's something that stuck with both Adam and I, say the most important square footage is outside of your home here in Vancouver.
Oh, I could not agree more. I think that's, you know, Yellowknife, I'm sure, has a lot going for it, but it doesn't have Stanley Park, and you know, it doesn't have the vibrant nightlife, and that's something that a lot of people like and are willing to pay for, and they pay for it not separately but combined with their home price. It's a package deal when you buy a home.
Mm-hmm. So, how's the market in the U.S., Teo, and where are you seeing opportunities right now for investors?
The market in the United States is for large cities are very similar to what you're seeing in Vancouver, which is to say we are well into the expansion phase, if not into the hypersupply phase. We are with the U.S. Obviously, like everywhere else in the world, was hit by the housing led financial crisis in 2008. But the recovery actually happened pretty quickly, and we're seeing now a shortage of labor and materials to build all the new space that people are demanding, both for homes as well as for businesses. But the bottom line is we're in it right now. We're very optimistic about the current market. We're very cautious about what's going to happen in about 18 months to 2 years from now. That is about as far as I would predict. Thinking about the comparison between economists and astrologists, I'm about 18 months to 2 years out in terms of my confidence of where we are in the market. I'll continue to watch employment. I'll continue to watch deliveries of new supply, and I'll continue to watch the number of units under construction. And if I start to see those start to be too overwhelmingly out of balance, then I'll start to be very worried about where we are.
And is there a certain market that you're most excited about right now?
Well, I'm excited about Denver. I love Denver's market. It is for me I grew up in Denver, so it's wonderful to see this our market develop. Colorado has one of the highest education levels in the country, so we see a lot of headquarters moving to Denver. And not too dissimilar from Vancouver, we have a lot of millennials moving here because they love the area. They love the lifestyle that you can enjoy in this city. You're seeing that in a lot of different cities, San Francisco, Seattle, Portland. We're seeing millennials who have a preference for the present and who are looking for the lifestyle that they can enjoy, and they seek cities where they can find it.
Right.
And so I look for cities where millennials are flocking to, because that indicates that high quality of life and suggests that people will want to stay. Even if they lose their job, they'll likely stay in the city because they came not just for a job, but for their entire lifestyle. And those are the cities that we're likely to see stability going forward.
Fascinating.
Yeah, definitely. So Teo, just before we wrap it up here, we know you're a successful real estate investor, but we're most interested in your mistakes. What are some of the biggest mistakes you've made along the way?
Sure. We don't have another hour or so, although I think it starts to touch the surface on that. The two biggest mistakes that I would say that I have made is, first and foremost, is keeping your eye truly on the real estate cycle, because there's a time to get in and stay in, and that's something that you have to be watching the market carefully for. You have to be checking in on a month or quarterly basis to watch where the market is. There was a lot of hesitancy coming out of the recession, and I was also one of those people that were very hesitant. You know, we live and learn. The other key thing that I suggest to every investor is keep an eye on cash flow. The real estate cycle is going to happen. There's going to be good times, there are going to be bad times. And you can survive the bad times as long as your property is cash flowing. That's one of the challenges we have to be aware of in Vancouver, is rental growth rates are on a return basis are not much more than interest rates. And once you deduct all of your expenses, and you know, the challenge is with interest rates going up and potentially rents having some downward pressure and certainly occupancies going up, you could quickly find yourself in a situation where the money coming in is not enough to pay for the money that's going out. And that's what causes bankruptcies in real estate. So my number one advice for people is to watch for cash flow. If you've got a cash flowing asset, you can survive a deep recession. But if your asset is not cash flowing, if you haven't positioned yourself to be able to survive for the long term, that's when unfortunately you experience people exiting the market and losing the property.
Very sound advice. So Teo, how can people find out more about your research and what you do?
Oh, sure. Well, they can look me up, Teo Nicolai. They can also check out Harvard Extension School. We have a phenomenal real estate program. Again, it's online. It's open enrollment, so anyone who's interested in learning more about real estate or even participating in our real estate investment certificate series, that's open to everyone, and we welcome everyone to join us, because real estate is a fascinating field. It's a lifelong exploration, and for me, I can't imagine a better field to be in.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, this is the closest Matt and I have ever got to going to Harvard, so we really appreciate your time.
Great. Well, it's been a pleasure. I appreciate you guys having me, and I'm continuing to look forward to seeing what you guys do in Vancouver and tracking that market. It's one of the most exciting ones that we have our eye on, so I'm eager to see how it goes.
Fantastic. Right.
Thanks again for your time, Teo. That was a fascinating discussion.
So there you have it, folks, our discussion with Teo Nicolai, founder and president of Nicolai LLC and Harvard instructor.
Wow, Matt, that was a really impressive conversation with Teo. And congratulations, everyone, because you basically just went to Harvard.
How you like them apples?
Okay, you're going to have to stop making that joke.
Wicked smart over here.
Yeah. But you know what? It's a lot to unpack, and we're gonna have a breakdown of his theories and ideas on our website. So
yeah, absolutely, we're gonna summarize it over there because we understand it is definitely a lot to unpack.
You had problems unpacking it, Matt?
I did for sure. It was a lot of information to digest.
It's not your fault.
Yeah, I know.
No, Matt, look at me, son. It's not your fault. So what else do we got today? We've got private client services. If you're not using private client services, you're standing still while the rest of us are power walking by. It's got listing updates 36 to 72 hours before public MLS. It's also got sold prices, full realtor level information,
days on market.
It is phenomenal. Go over there. It's the best research tool. We've gotten the best feedback about this research tool.
Absolutely.
And so many people are using it and so many people are really thriving with it. So head over to VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com and sign up today.
Absolutely. We also have a mobile app. So when you click research tools, there's two buttons there, PCS and the mobile app. The mobile app is for those of you who like looking at real estate on the go.
Right. Who doesn't like looking at real estate on the go?
Sitting on a park bench, riding the SkyTrain.
Driving your car.
Waiting for an appointment, not driving your car. But it's going to show you everything on the market, sold prices, has augmented reality. You're walking by a beautiful building in Yale Town. Hey, are there listings in there? You point your phone at it. It gives you the three listings that exist.
Yeah.
Prices, all the information. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
Sign up for that.
It's the
under
future.
Research tools at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Definitely. And while you're there, you might as well just sign up for our newsletter because it is the best thing out there.
That's a value add for sure.
It's got investment tips. You get updates of all the episodes. We give more information about the episodes. We give deal of the month.
We're also including those stats now. Sales ratios, neighborhood breakdowns, breakdowns on price bands. If you want to know exactly what's happening in a sub area of the market, the real estate board stats are great, but they're broad.
This is
next level in terms of getting down and dirty with those stats.
You could quit saying down and dirty with stats. It's uncomfortable. But yeah, sign up. It's amazing. It's the best research. It's the best research information out there, basically.
For sure,
If you're data-driven, which we are, you'll want to be on that list.
And if you have any questions at all, give me a shout. I'm always available, 778-847-2854 or matt@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or if you want to get down and dirty, it's 778-866-4574 or adam@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com with stats, man.
Yeah, exactly. We also have the nonpartisan line, info@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Excellent. Well, have a great week, guys, and we'll see you next Wednesday.
Take care.
My boy's wicked smart.
2,000 Spaces for Radio.
Subscribe today.